I believe in business here. Let's see. All right. Yes, we have been ready to rock and roll here. Wednesday evening. Great crowd. I don't know about the numbers, but it's a great crowd we got. And you're part of it. It's really remarkable how you get used to 70 degrees, 75 degrees, and it turns 40 and 38 degrees, and it kind of doesn't feel natural. You know, it just hurts. But we can survive. Thank you for being here, and thank you for your interest in studying the Bible. What we're doing this quarter, assigned, and there's a guy that assigned it, so if you have any problem with our content, you just talk to him. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All right? And today is the, let me ask George. You're just a man to ask this. What famous history-altering event took place on this day in 44 B.C.? B.C. What? Who? Oh, come on. I mean, we got history buffs in here. We don't have history professors or whatever. The Ides of March. There you go. Caesar, beware the Ides of March. That's what the soothsayer said. All right. Yes, indeed, the Ides of March. What does the Ides of March mean anyhow? Huh? What has that to do with anything? Well, it's right. It's about the 15th or the 16th of any month, right? Sure. Okay. I'm glad we got that settled. But anyway, it was a historic thing. And it wasn't too historic for Caesar. He didn't enjoy it as much as his opponents did, that is for sure. But we are in the book of Genesis. Obviously, this is where we're going to find our study about Abraham. Okay, and we'll do a little recap here in a moment. Before we do, we're going to address God in prayer. Let's pray, please. Our Father, for this good day, we are grateful for every blessing that you have given. Thank you that you have not dealt with us according to our transgressions, and you have not left us alone in our trials. Forgive our weaknesses as we realize we are imperfect individuals. And even if we strive, we are altogether vanity. Have us always approach a study of your word with utmost sobriety, and glean from it those lessons that we need every day. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, let's do a little recap on Brother Abraham. And we talked about Abraham, son. And I ventured to say that in all of the history of our race, no one stands above Abraham. Perhaps he has a peer. Perhaps Moses might be that one. But otherwise, it is my opinion that we are studying the father, in a sense, of the race, and certainly the father of the righteous, the father of the Jews, father of the Arabs, and the spiritual father of Christians, as we said. So let's talk about him. He was in the land of Ur, or Ur, as some people say, and Uli Brennan, some of you might remember Uli Brennan. He was a Bible teacher at Alabama Christian College many years ago. And he said, if I was to ask you where Abraham was from, and you said, Ur, he said, you would be right. Well, I guess that's right. Ur, or Ur, if you please. And he was told to leave and go to a land that God would show him. But interestingly enough, in the book of Acts, chapter 7, in verses 1 and 2, we find the account there that when Abraham went, he went with his father Terah and two uncles and a nephew Lot. But they didn't go to the land of Canaan, which is obviously where God wanted him to go. Now, we don't have that specific message to him that was given. We have the second instruction, apparently. And why the writers chose not to give us all the details, that's God's pleasure, of course. But you see the arrow, the red arrow here, if you look at Ur. And by the way, I don't know. I've been noticing this yellow splotch on our screen. I thought it was, you know, part of one of the lessons for a while, but it's obviously not part of one of the lessons. And I don't know what it is, Derek, but I'm going to commission you to find out what that yellow blob is up there. I mean, it may lend something to the content. I'm not really sure about that. But if we look at the red arrow, we see Ur over in the right-hand side over here, and that red arrow goes up to Haran, right? Now, that was one of Abraham's brothers, okay? And why they stopped there, the Bible does not tell us, but they did. And then when Abram got this second commission, a second charge to go, he did indeed go into the land of Canaan. But they didn't go that far. However, that was after his father Terah died. And we mentioned last week something about Terah that many people don't know, because the book of Genesis does not tell us this about Terah. Okay? We find it in the book of Joshua, and that is that Terah was an idolater, as probably the rest of these, except for Abraham. And maybe Lot was inclined that way some too, but Abraham must have had a good influence on him. So he came from a family of idolaters, isn't that interestingly enough? Yes, it is. But God had a special reason for him to choose him. And we talked about that, and we find the answer to that in chapter 18 and verse 19. After he had gone through the test of offering Isaac, and God said, I know Abraham, and I know that he will see that his family, not talking just about his children, but his whole household, would be obedient. What a great thing that a person could do. So this was quite a distance that he's going. It's some 420 miles from where he was down to Shechem and Bethel, where he went and, of course, built an altar. So the second call we find in Genesis chapter 12, and I'm calling it second call because I believe that's what it is. And this is one where God tells him, he gives him seven promises. Go forth from your country and from your relatives, from your father's house. Apparently, that's what he had in mind to begin with. But since his father went with him, he waited until he died. The land that I'll show you, I will make you a great nation. I'll bless you, make your name great. You shall be a blessing. And I'll bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I'll curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And we understand the last one, of course, to mean that that would be through his seed, through Jesus Christ, the Messiah. And so Abram, in fact, did go, and he built an altar. At some point, not too long after that, we talked about the famine that came to the land. And because of that famine, and we don't know if God sanctioned this or not, Abram went down to Egypt. And of course, we know from subsequent scriptures that Lot went with him down to Egypt. And it was there that he was worried about how beautiful Sarah was, Sarai, and he said, say that you are my sister, which she did. And then she was about to be united with the harem of Pharaoh, and God struck Pharaoh with some problems, and apparently gave him a message. Well, no, he gave him a message. And Pharaoh realized that Sarai was rich, really his wife. And so because of that, he sent him away, but he didn't send him a penniless. It sort of reminds us that when the people of Israel left Egypt many years later, some 400 something years later, after they had been in bondage, that the people gave them many things. Sometimes we overlook that. But they gave them many things to take with them on their journey. And that's why when they needed, or when Aaron needed the gold to make that golden calf, it just jumped out of the fire. And the calf just jumped out of the fire, as we know from reading the book of Exodus, when Moses accosted him about it. And he said, well, you know, the people came to me and this, they gave me their gold and so on, and which they did. They had lots of it. They got it from the Egyptians. That's where they got it from. So as a dowry for Sarai, before Pharaoh found out what was going on, he gave Abraham all kind of stuff. And then when he left, he gave him silver and so on. So he was quite blessed in an indirect way from going there. Still, we're not sure if this was actually God's will for him to be down there or not. Later on, we'll encounter Isaac, and we'll see a similar scenario. So as he came back, we are told, and let's see, let's pick this up here, in chapter 13, he went to the Negev, he and his wife and all that belonged to him, and Lot with him. And you notice the next verse says, now Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. And he went as far as Bethel, and you see on the altar here, on the map, that he built an altar there. Place of the altar where he had made formerly. And there he called on the name of the Lord. And that's sort of significant to me. He called on the name of the Lord as if he hadn't been calling on the name of the Lord before then, very much. But he made a specific effort at this time to call on the name of the Lord. And we see that Lot went with him. And then the problem of not having enough land, or I guess enough grazing lands for the two major flocks. These were not little flocks we talked about last week. These were huge herds of all kinds of livestock. Lot had quite a bit and Abraham had more. So they divided or parted because the land could not contain them. Now as we pick up here in right at the end of chapter 14, now let's go back. We don't want to get there first. Let's go to the first part of 14. Right. Okay. Bible has very small pages. All right. So Abram was just a great person. He actually deferred to his nephew Lot on the grazing lands. And we know that Lot, being apparently a selfish person, looked at this plain of Jordan, and that's what he wanted. So he took that. And then in chapter 13 and verse 14. We see, it says, well, before we get there, it says, now the men, this is verse 13 of chapter 13. Now the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord. But this is direction, and many times you've heard lessons preached about Lot and that he pitched his tent toward Sodom. He didn't go there in one fell swoop, but he pitched his tent in that direction. And oftentimes in life, if you start in a certain direction, you might end up there. And of course, that's what he eventually did. In verse 14, the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. All the land which you see, I will give it to you and to your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I'll give it to you. So it said that he pitched his tent, or moved his tent, and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which in Hebron, or Hebron. I never could figure in the Bible, sometimes we call this word Hebron, the people who supposedly know, but we've got Mount Hebron right here, about 30 miles away, up close to the lake, but it's all right either way. And there he built an altar to the Lord. And I'm not going to talk about all the things that happened in chapter 14 specifically, but what happened was there was a battle of what we call the petty kings of that area. And there were five of them, and they actually took over the territory of these cities on the plain, and Sodom being one of them, as a matter of fact. And in so doing, they captured Lot and his family. And they were on their merry way. When Abraham finds out about this, we look at chapter 14 and verse 13. A fugitive came and told Abram the Hebrew. Interesting, the first time we find that word attributed to Abraham, Hebrew. We are told, the commentators think, that this is from Eber, who was one of his ancestors. We don't know that for sure. We don't know where it came from, but there it is. So Abraham the Hebrew, now he's living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner, and these were allies with Abram. When he heard that his relatives had been captive, taken captive, he led out his trained men. How many trained men did he have? 318. Wow, isn't that really interesting? Here's a man that's just, he's truly, in a way, he's a settler. He's not done anything except he has his herds of cattle. He hadn't planted any corn or wheat or things of that sort that we know of. But he has in his household 318 trained men. You think he had anybody else? What do you think? Yeah, he probably had some servants that didn't go on this foray, right? He no doubt had, well, we know he had maid servants. Certainly his wife did. Now, we don't know the number of those, but we are certainly willing to say that it was probably several. And now he's got 318. I find that really unusual. That just an individual like this have 318 trained men that he could get to go with him. So he had these other allies here as well, and probably they had some men of their own. But the implication is that they were still, the numbers they had were inferior to the kings that had conquered this area and taken off the captives. Sir? Born of his house. Yeah. They were born in his family or extended family because he didn't have children. But yeah. Raised with Abraham. So that's really, really interesting. Yes, indeed. So, but he has great strategy here. He heard that his relative had been taken. He led these men out, went in pursuit as far as Dan. Where was Dan? We've heard about Dan to Beersheba, haven't we? So, this is a long ways away from where he was at the time. He divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of what? Damascus. Well, that's a long ways off, my friend. These guys had made quite a bit of progress in getting away from that area, but Abram was able to get them and bring them back. And I think it's really interesting here, the reference that he got Lot and his possessions and also the women and the people. If anybody is at risk when it comes to the war of this kind, even today, it's the women, isn't it? So this was great that he's able to recapture these and bring them back. Now, as we begin verse 17, after his return from the defeat, let's see if I can do this right. La-di-da. Yeah. Whoa, we don't want to cool that for. Here. So as he's coming back from the defeat of the kings, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now he was a priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And he gave him a tenth of all. And the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give the people to me and take the goods for yourself." Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have sworn to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread or a sandal thong or anything that is yours, lest you should say, 'I've made Abram rich.' I'll take nothing except what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them take their share." Some interesting things here. He meets two kings, as a matter of fact. One is the king of Sodom. And the king of Sodom says, "You can have all the stuff that you've gotten and you have recaptured." That was normal in such a case. Abram said, no, I don't want to do that. Whatever the guys have eaten that were with me and the others, they're entitled to that. But only what my men have eaten. I won't take a thread or a sandal. But then the king Melchizedek. Now we read about this king in Hebrews chapter 7, verses 1 through 10, and we'll not read all of that. But we find that he was indeed a king and a priest of God Most High. He was the king of Salem. Well, where was Salem? Anyhow, what do we later find Salem being known as? Jerusalem, that's correct. And in fact, we find that in the book of Psalms 76 and verse 2. We find that that is what Salem was called later. So here we have Melchizedek. It's obvious he is a type of Christ. He's a priest and a king, and his name meant King of Peace, as a matter of fact. So this man was an unusual individual. And it says in the book of Hebrews that he was without father or mother, and without beginning of days and ending of days or something like that. We can read it, but that's what the gist of it is. How could he be without a father or mother, Derek? I mean, only Adam is the one. Sir? Well, yeah, for the practical purposes of what we're talking about here, and the writer of Hebrews is talking about, that means he didn't have a king or a priest in his lineage that he descended from, and he didn't have one that descended from him. He was a special unit, if you want to call it that way. He was one alone. So that's really the way Jesus is, isn't he? He did have fleshly ancestry, but in a sense he didn't have. So that's why Melchizedek is a type of Jesus. So he didn't have beginning or end in that sense. Any question? Everybody understand what I'm saying? Well, we can look at the book of Hebrews and we can clarify that if you want to. I don't know if we've got enough time, but let's do it anyhow. Maybe this will clarify it. Ma'am? No, indeed. This man is a Canaanite. He's not a Levite. Okay, in Hebrews chapter 7, this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of Most High God, who met Abraham as he's returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham apportioned a tenth part of all the spoils, was first of all, by the translation of his name, King of Righteousness, and then also King of Salem, which is King of Peace, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, he abides a priest perpetually. Okay? So you understand what he's saying here. It means, some people think that this was an angel. You see, he was not an angel. He was obviously a king of this city and a priest of God Most High. So isn't it unusual that you find here somebody who's over here apart, a worshiper of God, priest of God Most High? I mean, he was right down the line, you see. And for that reason, when you read it from the book of Genesis, that you couldn't tell who gave the tenth to whom, but we understand from the book of Hebrews, and here the implication is that Abraham is the one that gave a tenth to Melchizedek. And the writer of Hebrews says what? That the man who's giving a tenth is inferior to the one receiving it, doesn't he? That's what he says. So that proves Melchizedek was, again, a special person here. Because even Abraham, who was looked on as a great person, is now giving a tenth to him. That's also contained in the book of Hebrews if we read it further. So I guess we understand Melchizedek. I hope we do. Beginning in chapter 15, the word of the Lord came to him. By the way, it came to him in a vision here and told him, do not fear, I'm a shield to you, your reward will be very great. And then Abram asked him about his offspring. But I want to pause for just a moment and ask, We have many times that first we had God told Abram to leave and go, right? And now we have a vision. There are many ways that God communicated, and sometimes we don't know how he did it. Sometimes it sounds like he was just talking with him. Certainly, Jesus is going to be talking to him later, and he looked like an angel to begin with, or a man to begin with, and find out that it's really Jehovah, or Jesus as Jehovah. And that's a little later on. So sometimes he just spoke, and there was a voice. Sometimes there were great events to happen surrounding that. Sometimes there were dreams or visions. So God communicated in the book of Hebrews. We find that in olden times, God in olden times spoke to the fathers in many different ways. But these days, he's spoken to us in his Son. But it is interesting that the different means that God used to communicate to Abram. And he tells him not to fear. And then Abram brings this up on his own. He said, what will you give me since I am childless and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? Since you've given me no offspring, one born in my house is my heir. So it sounds like he was thinking this Eliezer would be his heir as far as he knew at this time. God straightened him out on that and said, this man will not be your heir. This is verse 4. But one who shall come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. And he took him outside, and again, he tells him, look up to heaven, count the stars, so shall your descendants be. And now notice verse 6. It says what? It says, he believed God, and it was reckoned to him for righteousness. We find this in the book of James, don't we? Matter of fact, James tells us that it was reckoned to him unto righteousness, and that he was called what? He was called a friend of God. Isn't that interesting? He was called a friend of God. I know we all have friends, and we love them dearly, and it's wonderful to have good friends, but to imagine that you would be called a friend of God, that's pretty strong, isn't it? So anyway, he was called a friend of God. And he goes on down and said, how may I know that I'll possess it? So God tells him to bring an offering. We're not going to read all that, but he brings an offering. And it's interesting that the birds of prey came down upon the carcasses, verse 11. He drove them away, and when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. And behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. And God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in the land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I'll judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. We talked about that. And as for you, you should go to your fathers in peace. You should be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. And it came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. That's interesting, and I don't know what that means. But it looks like that Abram was really upset thinking about the prophecy that his posterity would be enslaved for 400 years. If it's not that, I don't know what it is. On that day, verse 18, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. I believe we have this on the, let's see, let's go one more. Yeah, all right. He's given us the boundaries here. The Kenite, the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, Perizzite, the Rephaim, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Girgashite, and the Jebusite. Now, that's a bunch of them there, right? I think that's maybe 10 of these people that inhabited the land of Canaan at that time. And so these are going to be the nations or the tribes, the territory of which Abram is going to inherit. And you notice it says that from the river of Egypt as far as the great river Euphrates. Now, there are several things here. But ask a question. The boundaries we understand. And he said, this is going to be theirs forever, right? So the second, number 11 here, was a promise completely fulfilled. And number 12 was a promise conditional in any sense, the land promise that we're talking about right here. And there we've got the yellow blob on the conditional again. Now, this takes quite a bit of explaining from one standpoint. And several years ago, I undertook to do a little essay on premillennialism, dispensational premillennialism. And there are 26 pages. Anybody who would like a copy of this would be happy to share it with you. But they today, your religious neighbors, believe, this is what Mike Huckabee, by the way, if you watch him on television and in Fox News, he didn't say this lately, but he believes this. He believes that Israel is entitled to the land of Palestine, which used to be Israel, ancient Israel. And he believes that we're supposed to support them in that effort. That's what he believes. And that's what probably your denominational preacher, pastor down the road believes. 90% of the religious world today, what we call the Protestant world today, believes that Israel is entitled to the land of Palestine that was promised to Abraham, or Abram, at this time. And for that reason, they don't really accept the teaching, the clear teachings of the Bible on that, especially in respect to the church that Jesus built. We don't have time to go into all of that. But let me say, I think it's 2010. On a flight to Israel on the 12th of May, something right there, I got on a plane in Newark, New Jersey, and I have never seen as many rabbis. They were everywhere. There was several hundred rabbis, and they're on the plane. And in fact, they disrupted the the stewards on the plane trying to serve a meal, because they all got over on one side and they were praying at a certain time. Okay? And you know what they were doing? They were going to Israel to celebrate Independence Day, for lack of a better term, for Israel. There's a long story behind Israel. I don't have time to go into all of it. But that's where they were going. And they believed, just like lots of other people believe today, that they were entitled to that land. Now, it's kind of interesting. After World War I, the British were given control under what they call the British Mandate for Palestine. And they were supposed to work out a satisfactory solution between the Arabs and the Jews. Keep in mind now, the Arabs had had that land from way back, maybe 1300, okay? And now things were about to change. Well, there were not very many Jews living in Palestine at that time. There were mostly Arabs living there. But over a process of time, they had an influx of Jews. And then after World War I, when the Third Reich came into existence and Hitler started persecuting the Jews, many of them fled from Europe and they went to the Middle East, specifically to Palestine. And about that time, Harry Truman, being the president of the United States, also believed, he was a Baptist, fundamental Baptist, and he believed that Israel was entitled to have a homeland, to have a state in Palestine. Okay? Now, after God destroyed that nation of people, well, there was two things that happened. Of course, in we talked about last week, the northern kingdom was taken away by the Assyrians. And then later, of course, the people deported into captivity and a remnant came back. But then in 70 AD, Jerusalem was destroyed. And from that time, none of the Jews knows what house family they were or are even today. They don't know that. The records are all gone. Okay? So that was the end of Israel. But it wasn't the end in the mind of some people. Harry Truman quibbled on this question right on up to the very end. And finally, he came down on the side of creating a state of Israel in 1948. 1947 for it to take effect in 1948. And so that's how it came about. It could not have been done without the mistaken support of President Harry Truman. In fact, his Secretary of State was so infuriated about this that he told him, if you were running for election, I would not vote for you because of this. He thought it was a terrible mistake. Keep in mind that this was all Arabs, just about. Just a few Jews living there. So what happened? That precipitated a war. The British had gotten tired of it, and they had just had, they'd withdrawn. So they didn't have anything to do with it anymore. And it was left up to the United Nations, basically, to take a side. And because the United States took a side, the United Nations took a side. And that's why, friends, we have Israel, a state today. It was carved out of a land that was not their land. And in fact, for a long, long time, and even today, there are more Jews living outside of Palestine than are living in Palestine, or about the same number, perhaps. But there was political pressure from the wealthy Jews in this country, and Harry Truman, his assistant, saw that as being a big problem for him, and so he caved in to that. That's not the only reason he caved in. It was because of his religious belief that he did. All right. So, but let's talk about the boundaries and see what happens here. Okay. Here we have repetition of what he's already told him. The ones where it is, the great river, the river Euphrates and the river Egypt. They don't interpret that. Scholars don't believe this means the Nile at all because the Nile runs, you know, south to north. Okay, but there is a wadi, a famous wadi there on the border of Egypt. It was, perhaps was a river, and they think, and I think rightfully so, that that's where it was. But it went all the way to the Euphrates in the north. Here's some more. Why do we know that the land promise was fulfilled? Because we see here, and let's see, if we look at Deuteronomy chapter 19, and verses 7 through 9, we find that there were, how many cities of refuge did he tell them they would have here? Three. He said, you're going to have three cities of refuge. But if the Lord gives you the land, and you see right up here, if he should enlarge your border, as he sworn unto your fathers, and give thee all the land which he's promised to give unto thy fathers, if thou should keep all his commandments and do it, which I command you this day, to walk, to love Jehovah, and to walk ever in his way, then shalt thou add three cities more for these besides these three. So if we read Deuteronomy there, how many cities of refuge do we find? Six. So what does that mean? If you had six cities of refuge, that means they had all the territory that had been promised to Abram. Now, the reason I'm making that point is that's the point that our denominational friends make today. They have never had all of the territory God promised them. You see, he didn't ever get up, but he did, as you see, because the cities of refuge prove that. Not only that, there they are, Kedesh, Shechem, Hebron, Bezer, Ramoth, I think it's Ramoth, and Golan. So Jehovah, as we see in Joshua, gave unto Israel all the land which he sware to give unto their fathers, and they possessed it and dwelt therein. Then we read about Solomon, 1 Kings chapter 4. And Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the borders of Egypt. Here we go again. You found his heart to be faithful before you and made with him the covenant to give his offspring the land of the Canaanite, Amorite, of the Perizzite, Jebusite, and the Girgashite, to give it to his descendants, and you've kept your promise for your righteousness. So the land promise was indeed fulfilled, right? And let's see here. And here, notice that it was a conditional promise, however. Yes, they were to possess it forever. But if you think about it, there are not very many promises of God that are not conditional. You may think of some. Of course, Judgment Day promise, that's not conditional. But I mean promises that he makes to people as an agreement or a covenant. You will not find any that are not conditional. But just as all the good things that the Lord your God promised you have been fulfilled for you, all right, that's the land promise, so the Lord will bring upon you all the evil things until he has what? Destroyed you from off this good land which the Lord your God has given you. If you've transgressed the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them, then the anger of the Lord will burn against you, and you shall perish quickly from off the good land which he's given you. So it is evident that the promise for the land was conditional on their remaining obedient. And also, if we read about the institutions of the, which we will, circumcision and the Levitical priesthood and the Passover, all of these were forever, right? But they weren't eternal. So forever is used, obviously, in a limited sense. All these institutions were done away with. We know that. So that's the reason that you can say that even when God said forever, he didn't mean today. He meant through their generations. And that's why, really, that can't be the bell because we just got started. That cannot be the reason that Israel deserves a part of Palestine today. Now, at this point, the United States politically doesn't have much of an option. We can't very well bail out on them at this point. But we have shored them up with millions, yay, billions of dollars of foreign aid. Let me tell you, don't get me wrong, I'm not being anti-Semitic here in any sense. But I'm just giving you the plain facts that Israel has no more of a claim to that land, really, legitimately, than anyone. And of course, it's never going to be a subject that'll be settled, just like Ishmael and Isaac and all of that, that we're still dealing with today. We're dealing with the Moabites and the Ammonites as well. All right, we didn't get through with what we wanted to say, but we got through with something. And thank you so much for your attention. I hope I didn't lose you with some of these things. If you want a copy of this, notes on premillennialism, it ties a lot of things together. Thank you very much.